Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. Today is Monday, June 7th, 2021, and I'm the host of the show, Cara Santa Maria. And before we dive into today's topic, I do want to thank those of you who continue to support the show. There are a ton of different ways to support it. All you got to do is visit my website to learn more. But specifically, I always give a shout out at the top of the show to my top patrons. Those are those who have gone to patreon.com/talknerdy and pledged their support. I usually give a shout out to those who pledge in the top tier every month, but I think I'll switch things up and give a shout out to my top lifetime contributors. And I'm going to do them in order. So here we go. Thank you so much from the bottom of my heart to Brian Holden, who joined in March of 2015, Jeffrey Sewell, who joined in February of 2015, Gabriel Felipe Jaramillo Gonzalez, joined in December 2015, David J.E. Smith, who joined in May of 2017, Charles Payet, who joined in April of 2016, Juan, who joined in June of 2015, Daniel Lang, February of 2017, Ken Pfeiffer, August of 2015, Juan Gutierrez in March of 2017. Thank you all so, so much. You guys mean an awful lot to me and everyone else whose name I'm not able to call each week. You are absolutely the heart of this show and you keep it going. All right, let's talk about this week's episode. I had the awesome opportunity to sit down with Dr. Iman Tadros. And Dr. Tadros is an assistant professor at Governor State University in the Division of Psychology and Counseling. Her background is actually in marriage and family therapy. Her PhD is in counselor education and supervision in marriage and family therapy. And we hit a bunch of important points. We talk a little bit about, you know, why women, especially women of color who have achieved a lot in their lives still aren't deemed as experts. We talk about the need for diversity within research and participants, and also a bit about her work in the criminal justice system, among other topics. This is an important one, and I don't know. I think you just got to listen. You just got to listen, and then you'll see. So without any further ado, here she is, Dr. Iman Tadros. Well, Iman, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks so much for having me.
I'm really excited to talk about like some important stuff when it comes to representation, when it comes to some social justice stuff, some racial inequalities, things that are really, I don't know, I found are super important to me personally, and I think are becoming more and more important to me, you know, professionally, clinically, but haven't often been the focus of Talk Nerdy specifically, solely because each week I interview a different expert about something often very specific, like let's talk about manta rays, and then it just like doesn't tend to come up. But so often I talk to women, to people of color, to different individuals within the sciences and even within other academic pursuits where these issues are really relevant. And so I'm just thrilled that we're, you know, we have a whole lot that we could get into today. I have a feeling the hour is not going to be enough time. So I'm going to try and pace myself.
It's totally not going to be enough time. And also, please do not ask me anything about manta rays. I have no knowledge on that at all. I could talk about so many things, but I could say that I know nothing about that. So yeah, not bad.
So first, let's establish kind of where you are from an identity perspective and where you're at from like an academic perspective. So you're an assistant professor in psychology and counseling at Governor State University. Have you always studied psych? Has this been sort of your like your goal all the way through your academic pursuits?
Oh yeah. There was a brief time when I was like eight that I thought I could be an actress. That didn't really work out. but other than that, I was one of those weird kids that always would like thought I would be a therapist. Which when you tell adults that, they look at you like, are you okay? Like, are you sure that's what you want to do? But yeah, so I definitely always knew that. And then my bachelor's was from Northeastern University in psych. And then I continued on for my master's in marriage and family therapy. And then my doc in counselor education and supervision in marriage and family therapy.
You know, it's interesting. I have a lot of colleagues now because I've gone back to school. I've mentioned on the show before, after being off for like 12 years, I think something like that, being out of academia, I went back to study clinical psychology. So I'm working on my PhD now. A lot of my peers, because I go to a kind of non-traditional school called Fielding Graduate University, so most of us are older students who are kind of career change or or like established in something related to psych, but not psych. And so a ton of my peers are LMFTs or LCSWs. So that's licensed marriage and family therapists or licensed clinical social workers, people from allied fields who decided to go back and do psychology. And so it's interesting to see that there's that kind of, I don't know, those fields oftentimes do coalesce, don't they?
Yeah, I feel like I'm always collaborating with sociologists as well, social workers, counselors. I feel like a lot of our work intersects, even though sometimes our fields try to divide the work we do. A lot of it is very similar. We just speak different languages.
Absolutely. And so there's kind of two sides that a lot of people do probably realize, but some people might not, to this kind of work. There's the sort of academic side or the research side, and then there's, of course, the practical or applied or clinical side. So, you know, marriage and family therapists, counselors, psychologists, different, you know, all of which kind of usually fall under the umbrella of psychotherapists. Therapists, they do intervention, they see patients, but many people also within these fields are simply doing research. Are you somebody who does both, or do you tend to spend more time in one or the other?
I clearly just don't like to sleep or have a life, apparently, because I do both. I can't say that one is my passion over the other. Right now, I guess because as a professor, you do a lot of supervision as well in a clinical program like mine. So, I feel like I really do both. It just depends on the day.
Mm-hmm. And so you're like right now, because I'm a trainee, I'm working within a specific setting. And ultimately, I do think that I'm finding my groove in end of life issues and psycho-oncology. So right now I'm working in an outpatient cancer center and love it. So I see a specific patient population that is all over the place, but still the commonalities that they're dealing with cancer in some form or the other. Do you have any specific patient population that you work with, or are you kind of more broad in your, let's say, in your clinical work, specifically your interventional work, not your research, which we'll get into in a minute?
So right now I'm supervising at the clinic, which is at Governor State, where we provide services to the community. So I'm supervising the students that are seeing clients there. Mm-hmm. I've done all different types of settings, like school-based, incarcerated facilities, clinical mental health, home-based, private practice, you name it. I just tried them all. What I found my passion was in working within the incarcerated facilities, because that's where I felt there was the most need. Not that there's not need everywhere else, but the need there was just so compounded by so many complex issues simultaneously.
Right. And so has that translated over then to some of the research that you've done and some of the more like professional advocacy work that you've done?
Yes, absolutely. If you asked me when I started my master's program, if I wanted to work with the incarcerated population, I'd be like, maybe. It just wasn't a thought. It wasn't like, no. Cause a lot of people have, a very large preference of not working with this population for some biases that our society has perpetuated. For me, it was more so like, I didn't think that's what I'd be doing. I always loved like Law and Order and every show related to the law, and I loved studying that type of stuff. But I didn't think that's where my clinical and research passion would be at all until I actually was in the room and just loving it.
Right. And so, you know, obviously there's a lot to unpack with regard to kind of the criminal justice system in this country, the inequities that we see, the social justice problems, the need for reform. And I'm interested, maybe before we get into some of the other research that you do, in diving into this a little bit and maybe talking about what are some of the things that draw you to correctional facilities and kind of how have you been motivated within that work?
So the need for justice as a whole, like on the macro level, I think really speaks to me. But then the way I see family therapy is that family is a very small unit, but how we were raised really impacts our future romantic relationships and friendships. And really starting at the micro level of one family that you can impact by being a therapist in the room, to then impacting the community, to then impacting like broader systems. And I believe that the criminal justice system in the US has completely failed so many individuals and families. And the work I do is in such a micro level scale when I'm in the room with just maybe 1, 2, 3, 4 people. But then the research really is macro level and how we can view these families holistically and how the justice system really does have these impacts on not only just one individual, one family, but the entire community and the country we live in.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting as a marriage and family therapist, you obviously have this perspective of sort of the family unit and talking about your impact as an individual therapist or as the impact of the therapist that you supervise or the trainees that you supervise, that can downstream really have a broader impact on the community. And it speaks also to the impact of parents. Just individual parents. You know, we all had parents. Some of us had chosen parents or parents that were chosen for us. Some of us had birth parents and, you know, every other combination therein. But the people who were the adults when we were very, very young, as you mentioned, they influence us to an extent that's almost hard to quantify. Like, it's almost so intense. Like, the influence is so all-encompassing that it's almost hard to wrap our heads around.
Yeah. I mean, the research on attachment has been around for a while and how our primary caregivers form attachments with us. So then how we form attachments in our future relationships. And because I do so much couples work, I always go back to that, like, attachment and what we're looking for in a partner. And did we receive those things when we were children? And I think that we know that from, you know, Psych 101 in our introductory psychology class. But I think we forget that when we're in romantic relationships and how the exact interactions and dynamics play out and how it affects us choosing partners and wanting to remain in partnerships and if we're satisfied and all of these other dynamics that come into play.
Yeah. I mean, I think sometimes in popular culture, we sort of simplify things and to the extent that they're no longer correct. And you'll often hear people say, oh yeah, well, so-and-so only dates her dad, or, you know, we all want to just like replace our mother or whatever. And it's not that simple, but it really is that there are patterns that we develop. There are needs. I love that you use that word because I think that's so fundamental. These needs that we have, whether they were fulfilled or unfulfilled, whether we were secure in how we attached to our parents or very insecure in our attachment to our parents, and that recapitulates throughout our lives.
I completely agree. And I also agree with the pop culture, like how, so if you just think about like social media, like somebody will just make kind of like make one post and then everyone will repost it and they'll say something like, tacos are my love language. But yeah, sure. Like, I love tacos too. But if you actually look into love languages, we love all of these things. It's what do we believe makes us feel loved the most, based on, you know, a whole plethora of things. But our partners need to speak our language to us for us to feel loved. So I think people, you know, they repost these things and like you're saying, it's oversimplified and then it ends up kind of being inaccurate information once it's like the game of telephone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's always been tough for me as somebody who's like really kind of skeptically oriented and very like, I'm all about that evidence-based perspective. And then when I went into psychology, I realized how, you know, there is a really big push for evidence-based intervention, of course, and there is a lot of really good literature that supports psychotherapy. But there's also a lot of like woo, and there's just a lot of, and not even within the field per se, although there is some woo within the field, there's some like pure pseudoscience within psychology, but sort of this self-help ancillary kind of movement. Because, you know, what's it fundamentally about? It's about leading better lives. And isn't that something that everybody wants? Everybody wants good mental health. Everybody wants to feel fulfilled and to have an authentic, you know, experience. Everybody wants to feel love and security and safety. And so I think oftentimes we grasp for very pithy and very thin tools that ultimately, some of which are incredibly helpful. And, you know, I'm not shitting on self-help movement. I think it's great if people want to read books and better themselves. They absolutely should. But some of it can be quite dangerous because it's promulgated by individuals who are not trained.
I completely agree. Like the culture of everyone calling themselves like a coach without having any training. Mm-hmm. I think that there's so many issues that have to do with that, because are you receiving help from somebody who's actually licensed and qualified, or somebody who's making a video and then you are taking the information from that video, bringing it into your partnership, and then trying some of these things out that may actually be really detrimental to your relationship.
Well, and that's, I think, such an important point, and something that a lot of people might not realize is that a huge part of our training is, and I'm going to say our, I think I can be inclusive, even though our training is different between MFT and psychology, but so much of it is about ethics. And so much of it is this truism that we have the potential to cause great harm when we provide a safe space where somebody can become incredibly vulnerable with us and open up in a way about their trauma, about their, you know, their psychopathology, their mental health issues. There's a real potential to do great harm if we're not incredibly ethical in our approach. And I guess that sort of pivots for me. And of course, you know, people who are not licensed and people who aren't trained, they don't, you know, have the same kind of structures, and that worries me. But beyond that, it sort of pivots to one of the things that's so important, especially in a more modern approach to psychotherapy, and sort of the ethics that we hold near and dear, and that really has to do with social justice. That has to do with racial and ethnic justice. It has to do with LGBTQI issues. It has to do with, you know, issues around identity and how the therapeutic relationship can help, but also can very much hurt if the individuals who have, quote, power are not well-trained in these areas.
And who are the people training? The people that are usually in power.
Oof, so yes.
That's a whole complex, sorry to just drop that
No, off. I think it's important because, you know, who founded the field? And like, are some of those lines have never been broken, right? It's great to see that the helping professions are, you know, populated more and more by women, sadly not enough by people of color. But, you know, like, who originally founded psychology and psychiatry? White dudes.
Yeah. And they're all old too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so like, and, you know, being gay was historically a disorder. You know, even trans individuals, there are still dysmorphia diagnoses that are like required in order to be able to get insurance coverage.
Too. It's still a thing in some states.
Oh, God.
Yeah, I was trying to
horrifying.
Work on that. I lived in Ohio where that was still advocated for by certain people.
What?
I was the family team leader for the American Association for Marriage and Family Therapy. And that was while I was living there. I don't live there anymore. I live in Illinois now. But that was one of the things that as the leader that, you know, I get to advocate on, and I get to state my opinion and how I am just like, this is ridiculous. I don't understand why. I mean, I guess I do understand why people believe it. I don't agree. So I have to take a stand as a leader to say point blank, this is ridiculous. And we're not going to support this.
Yeah. I mean, and the APA says the same thing and has for quite some time that like, not only does the evidence show that conversion therapy doesn't work, but that it's actively harmful, and that individuals who are, you know, LGBTQI are whole people who do not have a pathology, that this is a natural state of being, and that there is nothing wrong with them that needs to be fixed. And taking that approach is a detrimental approach. And the APA, at least, which is the American Psychological Association, our kind of like advocacy and union group for psychologists, takes a very firm stance. And if you, you know, if you do conversion therapy as a psychologist, you will lose your license.
So the problem is that people just won't name it that. You can go to a therapist that I think a big issue is parents bringing their children in, because obviously if you're 16, you're probably forced to come in with your parent for these issues. You're not really given the exact choice as a minor. If you're in your parents' household, and there's all these other issues, the therapist can still validate the parent's concern in a way that is harmful, and supports the parent's opinion or view on that, which can invalidate the child's views or lifestyle or just identity in general. So even though that's not technically ethical, you might still believe this as a therapist. And there are therapists, unfortunately, and helping professionals in general that do believe it is not okay, and I'm using that in their language, not okay to identify as LGBTQ at all. And I think that these ideologies are what's harmful, because we don't have to call it conversion therapy for it to still be harmful and destructive and awful.
Oh, you're so right. I remember being in a training session and it was, I can't remember. I feel like it was a racial justice course, but it was in the minor that I take at my university is social justice and diversity. And so I was taking like a seminar on racial justice and research. And there was a trainee who was talking about a patient that they had and they kept misgendering this patient. And I was like, wait, to be clear, so this is a trans child who identifies as male, so he's a boy, and she kept calling her a she. And I was like, wow, like this is the problem. You are a helping professional. Like you at the very least should be well versed in understanding trans issues, but also like accepting of these. Like this is out of your bounds of competence to be seeing this child. And I worry that this does happen a lot.
Unfortunately, yeah. And that's also the point of like the minimum qualifications and like kind of minimal competencies. Mm-hmm. Just like, I don't really know what other words to use besides minimal, like mm-hmm. using the right pronouns and, or even just identity in general, identifying someone's relationship. So not even specifically like LGBTQ issues, but if somebody says they're dating and you keep saying they're not as a therapist, or if they say wife and because they're not, you know, legally married and, you know, you're using the terms you want to rather than speaking their language and using their terms when it's their relationship, their reality, and it's just wrong.
You know, I so agree with that. And that's something that I have struggled with as an individual who is pretty active in the skeptic community is that, postmodernism, I think, is kind of like anathema to skeptics. It's like a four-letter word. And mm-hmm. Along with postmodernism comes constructivist thought. And I even did a whole talk, I think, in New Zealand or Australia somewhat recently, like pre-pandemic, about how constructivism is not a four-letter word. This idea mm-hmm. that, like, I agree with the skeptic perspective that there is an objective reality. I totally agree that the sun rises and sets. You know, I agree that the planets are where the planets are and, you know, that the cosmos works the way that physicists tell us it works. But that said, constructivism, as in we construct our own reality, I'm not a solipsist. I don't think that reality does not exist outside of me, but I do believe that for all intents and purposes, the way I interpret my reality is the only thing that guides my behavior, my feelings, my thoughts. And as a therapist, it is my job to empathize with my patients' constructed reality and to meet them where they are, to not change them from who they truly are, but to find in them their most authentic selves and to kind of, I don't know, aid them, be a partner with them in helping make difficult decisions or in dealing with life stressors. And this is something that's, I don't know why, it seems like it's been really hard for a lot of skeptics to wrap their heads around this idea that like there is an objective reality, yet we ourselves see it through our own lens.
So I have so many thoughts on this. One, you're literally speaking to my soul on this. Can you do a training just on this for mental health professionals? Please, I will.
Let's do it together.
I would love to. That'd be so awesome. I also have had this exact, and I want to say conversation, but it was more of a struggle/battle. Mm-hmm. We all, as mental health professionals practice from whatever theoretical perspective we feel connects with us, our clients, patients, our work in general. I created my own theory called the Tadros Theory of Change. And I've gotten a lot of pushback because it has some constructivist, So I don't know how to explain it in a way that I guess doesn't make me sound super biased because it's my own theory. I will acknowledge that it's super biased. So it has some modern/postmodern mm-hmm. views and people are saying you can't have both. And this is the easy way to explain it. A modern therapist would say they're the expert. And a postmodern therapist would say they're not the expert. In my theory, I can be the expert of therapy. I've done so much training on the actual process of therapeutic interventions. However, yeah. I do not believe I'm the expert of this person or their family. So I believe
or their life. Yeah.
They're the expert of their story, their narrative, their entire being, their relationships, their interactions, their dynamics. However, I'm the expert of therapy. So I believe that both and can be realities. Like mm-hmm. it's a reality that I have a degree and that they're coming to see me and they believe I'm halfway competent in my work. And it's also a reality that, and a truth that they are the experts and I don't know them outside of what they tell me and what they choose to share with me. So that's how I explain that both can be possible. But I've had a lot of people argue that no, you can't be modern and postmodern. But I think it's more so just, you know, what you were saying, there's some objective truth, like the sun, right?
Yeah.
We have information, like there's truth. I'm a therapist and I'm, you know, competent in doing therapy, as evidenced by degrees and all these letters and
yeah,
all
and reading stuff. The literature and keeping up with like the state of the, yeah. I mean, right. I have to say, I totally agree with that approach. And I mean, it resonates with me. My sort of theoretical orientation that I identify with most is existential, which, you know, has some humanistic things thrown in. It has some logotherapy thrown in, but like ultimately it's very existential. It's very based on Irvin Yalom. Anybody who hasn't read Irvin Yalom's books, I highly recommend it.
He has a new one
out. Yeah, he's got a brand new one out with his wife who recently died. They co-wrote it before she died. And he's not long for this world either, as he will tell you. I don't know, it's just a really compelling book. But anyway, I think that especially in the cancer setting, this really resonates with me because I truly believe that I'm not the expert of my patients' lives, that only they know what makes sense for them, what they can tolerate, what health looks like, what quality of life looks like. It's a big push-pull with cancer patients quite a lot, especially with those who have metastatic cancer, because they're often struggling with, well, my tumor markers look good. My oncologist says that my lab work looks good, but I feel like shit. I don't know how much longer I can tolerate this. And these end-of-life decisions are really hard because they ultimately rest in the hands of the patient. But so often we have taught ourselves as a society that they don't rest in the hands of the patient. They rest in the hands of the providers. And so that sort of, how do I ensure that my patient understands that I'm a part of their treatment team, that I have expertise, that, you know, I'm somebody that they can trust and that they can rely on and lean on, but at the same time, empower them and continue to support this idea that like only you know what your quality of life is, and only you know what you can tolerate. And that's where my advocacy comes in. Yes, it's with LGBTQI affirming issues, and yes, it's with anti-racism work, but it's also with end-of-life issues and advocating for right-to-die issues, you know, issues around dying with dignity, medical aid in dying, physician aid in dying, whatever you'd like to call it. Because I think that's like another civil rights issue that we're just really behind on in this country.
I mean, I have so many thoughts about everything you said. Until you said the word empowering, that was the first thing that popped into my mind. What you're doing is literally empowering others. And what the work you do is just so important. I hope everybody listening just knows how important the work you do is. And
I hope we all have access to somebody who's trained when we're, the thing is we don't. And I see that.
Yeah.
There's not that many people who want to do what I do. I'm not even trained yet. I'm not a psychologist yet. And so I can't do it without, you know, practicing under somebody's license and being a student. But I mean, ultimately I would love to see a center like this. I would love to see more psychologists and LCSWs and MFTs like working in these capacities, because I think that death is a massively taboo subject in our society. And it's a place where so many existential issues about identity and about legacy and about authenticity come into play. And we just pretend it doesn't exist until it's way too late.
Yeah. So I used to work in a hospital. I don't know if I said that on my whole list of settings I worked at.
I don't think you did, actually.
Yeah. It's because it's hard work. And I guess I just completely let that slip my mind because of how, you know, how sad you go home. Like, I can't imagine how sometimes you just need to unwind. But I used to do medical family therapy. And we used to have like treatment team meetings. And I used to work on a psychiatric unit, and it's just, there's so many coinciding issues. I've done research with the intersection of physical and mental symptomology and how they really intersect, even at a very basic level. Like if you are experiencing physical symptoms of stress as well as mental symptoms of stress, and then think about how that impacts your relationship. So there's just so many ways, and I can go on so many tangents, but there should be less stigma first. That's a whole separate issue. Mm-hmm. And then more of these trained individuals that are going to be working with not only the individual that has the, you know, disease or medical issue, but the family and those impacted directly as well. Because we, in our society, don't think necessarily conceptualize the partner of someone with cancer as being impacted. I mean, I'm sure people say like, oh, I feel bad for them, or they must be going through a lot, but it doesn't really go much further, like about how the mental health and physical health symptomology that they experience as well. And how it's truly systemic and relational.
It is. And then let's add to it some of the things that are so fundamental to you and my kind of intersecting interests. And that comes down to these like racial and gender and just like different identity concern. So you've got an individual who is trapped within a medical system that is not very affirming, that is, what's the word I'm looking for? Profit motivated. You've got individuals who are, you know, from communities that are lower SES communities or immigrant communities, or individuals who we know by, I mean, we know looking at the literature, just straight up, like being Black means you get worse healthcare in this country. Like just straight up being Black is predictive of worse outcomes across the board. And we can point to so many different examples of this. And I think mental health is one of those places where we can be bridging these gaps and where we can actually be really affecting change.
We could be. Unfortunately, we're really not. I think that's the issues that just kind of get swept under the rug, along with the many issues that we have in our current society. But you're exactly right. Like the racial and ethnic differences, you just can't, like you can't look at these facts, because there are these facts and statistics, and then argue that we shouldn't be putting more funding towards access to mental health care, for example.
Yeah. And this is something that you've specifically focused in different areas, like around, like we talked about homelessness, criminal justice, also specifically, there's an area of research that I'm really interested in diving into, which has to do with expertise and like how people perceive other people based on their backgrounds. And so I know this is a little bit of a turn, but I think it'll all tie up nicely with a bow eventually. You yourself are a woman from, what is your ethnic background?
So my mom was born in Cuba, so I'm Hispanic. Mm-hmm. And then my dad was born in Jordan, so I'm also Arabian. So I'm Hispanic and Arabian.
And then first generation of both.
Yes, both my parents moved here and are not from America. So from that perspective alone, both my parents had to learn English. And, you know, I was fortunate enough to be born here, so I didn't have to experience some of the, I would just say, struggles that they experienced. But then also being first generation, I didn't feel like I had some of the same luxuries and privileges as some of my peers that I grew up with. So I constantly have felt this like this privilege slash oppression. And this goes back to like some of the dualities we talked about earlier. But like I feel this dual, like I'm very privileged. I mean, I literally have the doctor title, and I have achieved a lot in my life, which is a privilege in itself. But I've also felt the oppressive nature of people just not really accepting that I can be both Hispanic, Arabian, and also educated.
Yeah. And this is something that like, it actually bears out in the literature, right? That like being not just, Hispanic or Arabian, or also like being a woman, for example, and of course, like fill in the blank with all of the other kind of underrepresented and disenfranchised groups in this country, that even if you have done everything and probably had to work 15 times harder to get those, those certifications, those degrees, those titles, those positions, that people still look at you and go, yeah, but I don't quite believe you. I don't quite think you're an expert.
Oh, I have so many stories on that. I mean, I got hired. Yeah. So my first class that I taught as a professor was at 24. So you can imagine how many times I got mistaked as a student. And then I saw my first clients at 23. So people would look at my finger to see if I'm married, because how dare I be qualified to do couples therapy without having a ring on my finger. And also being 23 years old. And then I also look younger than I am, which I'm sure will be great in the future. Looking forward to that. But in my career, that has definitely not helped me. And when I worked in an incarcerated facility, somebody thought I was an incarcerated individual and yelled at me when I did therapy in a high school. I was, I think, like 25 or 26, and I got yelled at because to go back to class. Right. So those issues persist, and now I kind of laugh at them. But at the time, it's just very frustrating because even if I was 16, what gives you the right to yell at me instead of ask me to go to class? So like those types of issues, or because I'm an incarcerated individual, I should be getting treated like actual crap. Because the way they told me to like get back in line, I didn't know what to do. I just froze. I'm like, oh, do I get back in line?
Right. And that was like an ounce of a taste of what it's like for the population who lives there all day, every day.
Oh, yeah. And I would hear about it, but actually experiencing some of that cruelty is what I would call it, because it's cruel to just yell at someone for no reason. And then I think also, do people view me as an expert? Do people that look like me actually get the jobs that I get? Not really. I'm usually, when I teach doc classes, I'm one of the youngest people in the class and I'm the professor. So there's also some stigma. Even recently, I was collaborating with a student. I'm technically their research mentor or research supervisor, whatever it's called. And they said, thanks, bestie. And I didn't know how to respond because technically I'm not her professor, but I'm her internship supervisor, or I don't even, like I said, I don't even know the exact title. So it gets a little bit messy. But usually, you know, bestie wouldn't be appropriate, or, you know, like just students have said things that I'm thinking that if I was 57 and a white male wouldn't happen.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I mean, we see this play out over and over again, and it actually leads to real world consequences. It leads to lack of advancement within careers. It leads to being overlooked for certain types of, you know, promotions or for awards. And it also just leads to individuals starting to, I think, internalize that sort of gaslighting. And ultimately, you have this now, this dual pressure. You've got the pressure of like the world saying, I don't buy it, I don't believe you. And then you have the pressure on yourself of saying, maybe I shouldn't believe myself. And now I'm not going to, you know, push. And that's the, I think, the saddest thing. I mean, it's fucking sad to me when you see somebody who is like just beat up by the world. And it's extra sad when you see somebody who has learned helplessness because of it. And it happens to like all of us.
Yeah. Now with the whole doctor title, since I was 27, this doesn't happen as frequently, but before having this fancy little title, a lot of people actually, like I would, maybe this is a researcher in me, I would love to have surveyed anonymously how many people would have thought that I was actually not intelligent. People didn't think I was smart, like my whole life. It was just weird. I mean, it's kind of just saddening to think about that, like, people that either look like me, sound like me, just have, you know, my demographics on paper are just going to be seen by the world so differently. So, so I had an ex, for example, that I would tell him what to say to people when we were like either negotiating for something or when he needed to call like a business or just even saying things to other people. He was my mouthpiece. And because he was a white male, people treated him so different. We even tried it. We experimented with this a little bit. I would say the same line and somebody would react so differently to him than me. So we ended up just kind of like skipping over and being more efficient. And I would tell him exactly what to do or say, and he would do it. And it would just be so much more efficient. But how sad and terrible is that in general, that he was my age and I had more credentials than him and more expertise in most of the things that we were talking about and doing, and he was used as a mouthpiece. And I think about that in the broader societal context of how am I supposed to be an advocate for all these things that I care about and for all these people that are not as privileged as I am. And I can't even be their mouthpiece for them because the society won't even see me as knowledgeable as someone with less degrees than me and even my same age and just being a white male.
Yeah, you know, I think that tracks for so many women, so many people of color who are listening to the show right now are probably like bursting to like yell out their examples of that, you know. Mm-hmm. And I have too many to count. The one that comes up for me pretty kind of like saliently has to do with back when I was, I think I was a the Huffington Post. I was at a journalistic outlet and I was doing videos for a series. And my producer is an older, you know, white guy, good friend of mine, actually, gay. But I would say that it was a less clear to the individual that we were interviewing. Something that they would stigmatize him for. And so I remember, again, my producer being there with me, and I'm a researcher. I, at this point, have like a master's degree in neuroscience, and I'm the host and co-producer of this series, and I'm the one interviewing this Nobel laureate who's, you know, probably 90 years old. And I'm asking him like sophisticated scientific questions as part of the pre-interview. And he keeps turning to my producer and answering my producer. And my producer finally is like, I don't understand anything you're saying. I'm just here to get a good shot. Like, I don't, you should talk to her. And it was just bizarre how, like, I would literally ask him a question and he would like physically turn his body in order to answer the person who did not ask him. Assumingly because he is a man and his brain is more capable. I mean, it was the craziest experience. And of course, this is just an extreme version of shit that happens all day, every day in these like little microaggressions and these, you know, yeah, minimizations.
It's you're speaking my language completely. I actually got a paper rejected last week about microaggressions because it doesn't exist. A reviewer
said, so ironic.
Yeah. So that's exactly what was on my mind. And you were saying extreme example. It's an actual like everyday example that happens so often that I wish I could say I was surprised by your experience, but I'm like, of course. Especially, yeah. I think, and this is just something that I've noticed. And there's obviously a lot of research on this too. Being young and female already gives us that. Like, I guess that notion that we are not qualified. And then
and not smart.
It's just, we talk about it in such a normal way, but it's honestly insane.
Yeah. Oh, it's insane. It's absolutely, I was just watching Master of None. I've been catching up on it. And there was an episode where Dev, who's the main character played by Aziz Ansari, is talking to one of his coworkers, who's like a younger black woman, on a TV set. And he's like, you know, she's like, how was your night last night? And he's like, oh, I stepped in dog shit when I was walking home and it was horrible. And then like this thing happened and that thing happened. And he was like, how was your night? And she was like, oh, this like creepy dude followed me all the way to my apartment. And he was like blown away. He was like, what? And he's talking to all his girlfriends at the bar about it. And they're like, oh yeah, that's happened to me. And he's like, what? And they're like, yeah, like every girl has been through that like multiple times. And then, so they're all sharing their story and he just like has no idea. And that's, you know, that's like privilege, right? That's like what we're talking about when we talk about privilege. It doesn't mean that your life isn't hard and that you don't deal with your own shit. It's just that like, you don't have that thing, that extra
obstacle.
You don't even
know about it, or you're acting mind blown. Like when you were telling your story, I'm like, yeah. Sort of like 17,
you're like, yeah, of course.
17 other ways that I connected that I was like, okay, we only have an hour. Let me not tell every single story, but we could be talking about this all night. And I am thinking that, especially like even men I've spoken to, like in my own family, my own friends, they are like, that's happened to you? And I'm like, oh, that happened to me last week. Do you want to know what happened 3 years ago and before that? And like, they just don't even, it's such privilege to not even know that these things happen, but then not to have it happen to you, not to know about it. It's like, how could you pretend that you don't have these, you know, these luxuries in your life? To not have to deal with this.
And like, we can talk about it as these like things that are like eye rolls, and really they're actually much more pernicious than that. But we talk about them like they're eye rolls because it's like a survival, you know, instinct. But like, I think that probably if you surveyed most women and you really, really specified what you mean when you ask the question about sexual assault, that almost every woman will say that she's been sexually assaulted. I think that sometimes when we look at the data, it has to do with the fact that we, for example, minimize things that we see as being not overly pernicious. And we think of sexual assault as being rape. Yet, like, I've been groped on a subway. I've been groped at a concert. I've had the, you know, and like, I'm like, oh yeah, I guess that is sexual assault.
Oh, I mean, so I always think about in research in general, it's all about the measures. So if we are measuring sexual assault as just rape, then you will of course have statistically less numbers of women that were raped rather than molested or touched inappropriately or all of these other things that are sexual abusive behaviors. And then also like how we conceptualize trauma. Like sometimes we don't think of a trauma response as like freezing in a conversation or people pleasing, but these are traumatic responses. And then I always remind people too, like, you know, you probably think that this has happened to you because it's your own experience. And sometimes we're very egocentric, but a lot of times we are sitting in a room or living with someone who has also experienced these things. And we just don't talk about it because it's stigmatized. There's just so many taboo topics that actually are more detrimental to mental health to not talk about than to actually talk about these things. And a lot of times we avoid these topics because they're uncomfortable to people that haven't experienced it. But why aren't we having these conversations so that the people that have actually experienced these traumatic events are more comfortable and they can talk about it and they can voice it? And we want to like silence people into submission a lot of times instead of actually having these conversations that can really help people.
Well, and that so echoes with like the state of race relations right now. I mean, exactly. It's exactly that. Like, it's all about white fragility. Like, so often, you know, Black trauma, for example, is minimized simply to make the white people in the room feel more comfortable because somehow it's gotten to a point where the idea of being called racist is somehow more offensive than the actual racism that is perpetrated against Black people every day. And it's mind-blowing that we live in a society where that's the case. I mean, we have to get to a place where it's safer to talk about these things out loud. And the fact that the people who have privilege are going to feel a little bit uncomfortable will fucking deal with it. Like, that discomfort is a fraction of what the individuals who have experienced the trauma are actually carrying with them.
So I have a perfect, horrible story that relates to this. So I did a workshop at a social work conference in LA. This was, I think, 2018. And because I have family there, I was a badass. And I snuck my cousins in because, of course, they wanted to see me present. And also the topic was just interesting. It was about culturally competent care. And, you know, I thought it was a pretty basic workshop about how to incorporate, you know, cultural humility into therapy. I thought it was just a very basic hour-long workshop. I didn't think anything would go wrong. Of course, when you talk about anything about racism, microaggressions, or cultural humility, there's always backlash and it's always harder to even get these papers out. It's harder to have conversations. There's more pushback. I expected some pushback. Did not expect what was going to occur. I have some Gen Z cousins that were there. So of course they were like videotaping it. So I was really happy for that later.
Oh, good.
Yeah. I got to see my reaction. It was more so about like seeing how I reacted to it. But what happened was I made what I thought was like a very general statement. I said, as mental health professionals, at some point in your career, you will work with someone who doesn't look like you. Who doesn't identify as you do. I thought that was very basic. For example, like I've worked with plenty of men and I don't identify as a man. So like my statement was, I would say probably as general as you can get. I had a man stand up and basically berate me, telling me that he has never worked with someone that doesn't look like him. Like he was saying that first he started with, where did you get this information? Is this your experience or is this research? And I said both. He asked me, where are my citations for this? And I'm thinking, I don't cite every single one of my statements, but okay. And then, so I challenged him and I felt a lot of anger inside because he's taking a lot of time away from the workshop to just talk over me and stand up and get angry. And my workshop was full. So I'm thinking somebody else could have probably benefited from this more. But then again, maybe he was the one to benefit from it the most. But my thought was he's challenging me so much, maybe because, you know, I'm in my 20s and I'm speaking at this workshop at this great conference. And he's annoyed that we're even talking about racism in general. But he basically, when I asked him the question, you know, have you never worked with someone like you? He said, no. I said, really? You've never worked with women or children or anyone
right. Who
isn't white? I was just genuinely confused. Of course, there was a fire inside me. So I'm thinking I'm probably being aggressive or angry or annoyed because this is ridiculous. And also you're just being disruptive and rude at the very basic level. And actually like some woman stood up for me during, she's like, okay, well, I think she answered her questions. Can we get back to it? And of course, I'm so glad for my Gen Z cousin in the room who was live recording this to Instagram the entire time. That shouldn't have been there in general anyway, but I saw my reaction later because they were saying I handled it well, and I was like, no, I definitely didn't. I need to focus on my reaction to them. But I guess I felt that fire inside, but I did ask, you know, important questions, and I did try to answer him. He ended up walking out and leaving me like a terrible, terrible evaluation, saying that I have no idea what I'm talking about and that people like me shouldn't present. And it had to be him. There was no other review like this. And he did state in that he had to walk out because it was so uninformative and things like that. But those are people that are licensed to help others in the community. And mm-hmm. to me, that was just such a, I don't want to say yeah. eye-opening experience, because I knew that this was occurring, but I didn't know it was like people like me, people that are advocates for the community. Someone, he was a social worker, and right. he doesn't need to learn. He was calling them tips to help.
Tips.
People. Yeah. Tips to help people that don't look like him, because he doesn't work with you. And I'm thinking,
oh my God. And you're like minimum competencies, like minimum.
Yeah. Like, and wow. This is LA. So I'm like, I don't know if you're from here or this is the conference. I mean, I wasn't living in LA when I was doing this. So I'm like, I don't want to assume where you're from, but I highly doubt you've only worked with older men like yourself ever. And if you do, oh my God, then, you know, that private practice, I don't even know what to say. I have no words, but
I know, like, how are they even attracting? Like, is it like whites only on the door? Like, yeah, I live in LA. I definitely don't only see white patients, and I don't only see female patients, and I don't only see young patients.
Right.
That's bizarre too. And I don't only see, you know, Latinx patients. It speaks to, I think, something that was recapitulated in White Fragility, if you haven't, just for people listening, if they haven't read that book, this idea of these kind of like cultural inclusivity seminars that Robin DiAngelo, the writer of the book, who's a white woman, by the way, talks about, and you know, her learning curve and what she constantly is, you know, going up against when she goes into these corporate settings and she teaches about inclusivity, and that it somehow always becomes about the white person. And it always becomes like, there's a whole chapter called like White Women's Tears. And that's like really, you know, I mean, I feel like I don't even have to go any deeper into that, although she does do a great job of going deeper into that. And it's frustrating because it just reinforces this, this normative versus othering that occurs within, you know, especially within our society, but I think Western society in general, that like the white male, straight, religious, you know, blah, 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 blah perspective is normal, and that everything else is other.
And that everything else has to abide by those rules, those customs. And I think in that workshop, what that taught me too, is I'm nervous as the person leading the room, because I am the one in charge per se. Like, he's controlling the narrative. He's taking time away from the workshop to have a temper tantrum, essentially. And should that be allowed? No. And, you know, I'm thinking, I always think about like how I can handle situations better and how I can improve and grow and all of these things. And me being like 26 in the room and thinking like, do I know what I'm doing? I don't even have my PhD yet. Like, he's questioning my expertise, and that's making me question myself to an extent. And I'm thinking, how did everyone else in the workshop perceive this? I'm scared of my evals. I'm scared of not being invited back. I'm scared of all of these things of people already don't see me as an expert. And this guy's openly challenging me and walking out and slamming the door and all these things. And these are things that we face as women of color all the time. And I think that if we're not well represented, especially in the scientific community, in academia, in the therapy room, then we have a major problem of who's controlling the narrative of the research and controlling who is even developing culturally sensitive interventions. Is it also older white males that are doing this?
Right.
And there are older
or who's editing them, who's, you know, who's deciding whether they pass peer review, who's, it's like, there's so many gatekeepers.
Well, and there are older white males that, you know, are knowledgeable on these topics. Like, I love the work of Tim Wise. And I believe too, that who is invited to these workshops are, like you're saying, just passing out peer review. There's always someone that has to approve these things. So if I don't pass, then is my work going to get out there? Am I going to be silenced? And I feel that I have been in many ways before. And people like you who have this type of platform would need to give me the opportunity to speak, because I can't be heard if I'm being silenced and being told, no, you can't speak or, you know, your work isn't valued, or cite your one sentence that you said in an hour long workshop kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, it goes beyond this like imposter syndrome thing that we often talk about. And it goes into this area of like gaslighting. It goes into this area of, you know, active harm that ultimately, you know, removes people from, you know, it's like we talk about this leaky pipeline. It's like, no, it's like a pressure pipeline. Like, it's not just that it's leaky and women are just falling out of it, or people of color falling out of it. It's, they're being actively pushed out. And ultimately, oftentimes made to feel like it's their own fault, like that, you know, made to question their own competence. And, you know, that's, I think, the extra kind of pernicious side of the gatekeepers being those who are, who have developed over many, let's say, millennia, a high level of skill in maintaining power.
Right. I mean, I think that there's so many issues that are embedded in why, for example, women of color are not in positions of power, and specifically like academia too. And I mean, they're not in positions of power in many senses, but I'm speaking to my own experiences and like academia and like my own field. But what can we do about it? I mean, there's plenty of things we can do. It's just that I guess I'm in a position of partial power, I would say, because there's certain things I can do, but I'm still at the assistant professor rank, not at a full professor rank. And I saw a tweet recently that was giving the statistics of Latina professors, and it was saying that only 3% of all professors are Hispanic women.
Wow. And
I was like, that's really sad. And then it said less than 1% make it to full professor of. Yeah, and I was mind blown, and I was thinking, well, I'm actually not surprised. I mean, I was getting passed down on so many positions that some of my peers that had way less publications and had less of a licensure status than me and have taught less and all these things were, you know, getting positions that I simply wasn't. And I was just hungry to find out why. If my credentials are beating them out, then is it me? Is it how I look? Because I look very, very white, with straight hair and, you know, my white skin. I can just not tell someone I'm Hispanic or Arabian until they find out my name. And then there's usually a question there. But right. I mean, if my name was Ashley, I don't think we'd be having the same conversation, that certain people and I have. I do have the privilege of, I guess, excluding that information if my name is Ashley and I do not want to say I'm Hispanic. I don't think people can tell by my accent or anything. They might just think I'm a white woman, and I wonder if that would give me more power.
Absolutely. I mean, and that's something I've often struggled with as being, you know, somebody who's biracial, my mother's from Puerto Rico. I'm, you know, my last name is Santa Maria. I'm a Latin woman, but I'm super white, and I, you know, I carry the privilege of my white forward-facing identity. Like, if you pass me on the street, I'm not going to experience the same things as a Black woman or as, you know, a woman with darker skin, regardless of her ethnicity. And that's, you know, it's complicated, right? It's a complicated thing to have privilege of being, like you mentioned, educated, or privilege of presenting as white, or the privilege of being, you know, bi, but not gay, or gay, but not trans, or, you know, whatever. Like, there's always some other version of oppression and of difficulty. And I think one of the hard things that we forget sometimes, and I think Daryl Tsu Wang does a really good job of talking about this in
his work.
I know, he's the best. And he talks about how, like, we cannot engage in oppression Olympics. It's something that we often will see when there's tension, let's say, between, like, the American Jewish community and the American Black community, is you'll see this, like, tension and then these, like, oppression Olympics, like these one-upmanships. And the truth is that doesn't help anybody. We have to be allies, especially those of us who have a shared empathy. And so when you ask, like, what do we do about it? I mean, like, obviously it's such a Sisyphean task. Luckily, I think it is changing, because young people are just like, I don't even get what it means to be backward, like my parents were. Mm-hmm. And that's amazing. Mm-hmm. Sort of like just the line in the sand is moving every day. But I do think that, like, we have to be allies. Like, if somebody is being overlooked in a meeting, I'm going to elevate their voice. And then if my voice is overlooked, I hope that somebody else who has just a little bit more power will elevate mine, and down the chain of being allies, but also really understanding our place as an ally. And that's, it's not about taking somebody's idea, and it's not about making sure that my voice is heard. It's about making sure that I'm amplifying the voice of somebody who is being silenced.
Well, you're literally doing that right now. I mean, I'm a woman of color, and you're elevating my voice to your platform. So it's actually, you're doing exactly what you're saying right now. And I think what you're saying about allies, we do have to be. And I believe I try to do that every day, but I still am being silenced myself. So how do I help, you know, my clients and my students have their voice be amplified if a lot of times mine is silenced?
Yeah.
And I do try to be very loud in the metaphorical, but also the literal sense.
Yeah, I love that.
I am heard, but sometimes that's not well received. And then, you know, it's the aggressive woman mentality or the intimidation factor that's there, which I don't feel I'm intimidating at all, but I have loved ones that are very honest with me, and they're like, no, you're super intimidating. And I'm like, oh my God, really? Like, I really don't want to be. That's awful. Like, I don't like it in that sense. Like, I would rather be like fierce in my work, but also be super approachable. But then I also think about what you said, like how people perceive us is super important for our clients specifically. So I've had some clients that it was really important to them to know what I am. And they felt like I heard sighs of relief, but they actually reported feeling relief when they found out that I wasn't white, when it was clients mm-hmm. of color. And I'm specifically thinking back to like one specific couple. Mm-hmm. And I mean, so many stories are flooding through my head right now, but that they have actually felt better because they felt that I understood their experience.
Yeah, I think it's why a lot of patients, mm-hmm. you know, or clients prefer working with individuals, you know, who have that experience. Like, obviously, it's very common for Black patients to want Black therapists. And yeah. the problem is that there aren't enough Black therapists because the gatekeepers are keeping them out. Like, this is problematic and this has to change. You know, what you mentioned before really resonated with me, and I pulled up, I was like, I know there's a really good quote by Jane Goodall, and I've mentioned it recently, but I'm just going to say it again. This is Jane Goodall actually said this, and I love it so much. It actually doesn't take much to be considered a difficult woman. That's why there are so many of us.
Ooh.
So we have to remember that, like, we aren't being difficult. Society wants us to shut up. And,
yeah.
and, you know, and be, you know, seen, not heard. And just being heard means that some people are going to perceive us as difficult, and that's their problem, not ours.
I think that was just amazing. I actually have not heard that quote, but I guess I'm a difficult woman. I mean,
hell yeah. Love it. Wear it like a badge of honor.
Yeah. I mean, I'm going to hashtag that later and say difficult woman and just roll with that. I think that, you know, we wouldn't be called difficult if we were just going by the status quo and not challenging these things. So yeah, I guess I'm a difficult woman. I also think it's a cultural thing too. Like in my own culture and family context, if I just decided to not work and go back and live with my dad as a 29-year-old woman, and just be like, yeah, I'm going to be a housewife, like husband, come get me. You know, that would be fine. Nobody would judge me. They would think that's normal. I was always questioned, oh, you're going to go back to school again? Because, you know, 4 degrees was way too many, way more than I was supposed to have. You know, none would have been ideal originally for some people. And then I think, you know, that makes me less marketable for a husband. Isn't that?
Yeah, it's, you know, there's something comes up for me when you mention that. There's a documentary called Science Fair, and I actually had the directors on the show a while back. So you guys can look up that episode. It's called Science Fair with Christina Costantini and Darren Foster. And highly recommend this documentary. It's so good. And it follows kids who are doing the ICEF, you know, the International Science and Engineering Fair. And one of the girls that they focus on, and I feel really guilty, but I don't remember her name off the top of my head. I think she might be Indian. She's definitely South Asian or Southeast Asian. And she comes across in the first few minutes, a lot of people have the same experience where they're like, ooh, this girl is full of herself. Like, ooh, this girl, she's a talker and she's got, but then you really realize very quickly, no, this girl's just confident and she's confident for good reason. She's brilliant and she's, you know, she knows her worth in this world. And it's like, I had my own internalized sexism that I brought to the experience of viewing this. And within minutes, luckily, I was able to check myself and say, God, I wish all young girls would be like her. Like, why is it that I get a bad taste in my mouth?
Because when we're not supposed to be confident. We're viewed right. as conceited or cocky.
Right. Mm-hmm. And so it's like this shift needs to occur. And I do think it is occurring. But we need to recognize it and reinforce it. And, you know, like you said, kind of empower it, be allies for it. Because for so long, we have had to navigate the world coddling the egos of those who might be offended by us just being ourselves. And I don't know about you, but I'm sick of it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I notice myself doing it sometimes. I'm like, wait, why am I being so nice to this person who just said the rudest thing? Like, why do I feel the need to be nice? I know that there's some academic term for this, but basically I've read about this research a couple years ago that people of color feel the need to kind of make the person who's making these statements feel better.
Yeah, feel safe. Too. Yeah, like I need to make you make sure that you're safe around me, that I'm not threatening to you.
Exactly. And like you go kind of out of your way. And I know that we talked about like people pleasing as a trauma response. Like I am a total people pleaser. I want everyone to feel comfortable all the time. So then in learning, in therapy, in school that I'm not allowing them to feel the discomfort that they should feel in the interaction. Like I had an experience in my master's where I was working in the incarcerated facility and there was a male who was physically, emotionally, every type of abusive to his female partner. And I was still somehow like scared to challenge him.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to like work on myself. Like, why am I scared of him? Is it like that I don't feel comfortable challenging him because I want the peace in the room and I want them to feel comfortable? But no, he should feel the discomfort of, no, you physically assaulted your partner. You should feel uncomfortable for your actions. Why do I want you to feel comfortable as the abuser? And of course, I want her to feel comfortable naturally as a victim in this situation. But isn't it okay to feel the discomfort in general? But then especially within like conversations about race, why do we want everyone to feel comfortable? It's okay for us to feel uncomfortable.
We need to feel uncomfortable.
Exactly. And you should feel discomfort in the room if you are perpetuating racism and if you are making rude, ridiculous, horrific statements that are discriminatory. Nobody
or
should
even
feel
if you're just,
discomfort.
Yeah, even if you're just complacent while other people are doing so, even if you're just sitting by and feeling the discomfort of somebody else making that statement and then not saying like, bro, what are you saying? Like, why are you talking like this? Like, this makes me feel uncomfortable, you know, like what, don't be a child or whatever the case may be. And I think that's the difference, right? Is that for so long, our priorities, our moral priorities have been on like just comfort and I'm not talking about deep, like Maslow's hierarchy of need comfort. I'm talking about like superficial, thin, you know, just let's not talk about anything taboo. Let's not, you know, bring any emotions up. Like we have for so long been like a stoic society. And again, not like the actual stoics, the philosophers, but like the more colloquial use of the term, let's just, you know, not feel. And it's been very detrimental. And I think I've mentioned this before on the show, but a good documentary that dives into some of these issues, especially around masculinity, is The Mask You Live In by Jennifer Siebel Newsom. And she talks about how we have raised our boys that the only like appropriate emotions to express are emotions like anger, and how that has a direct link to aggression and violence later in life. I mean, like a direct link. And so I don't know, there's a lot there. There's obviously so much here. There's so much with like the incarcerated population that we didn't even get to get into, but we're now over an hour and I can't keep you longer and I'm super bummed. Is there before?
You can keep me as long as you want. Like, like I'm ready to go. I already have like 7 thoughts from what you just said.
Oh no. Well, let's do that then. Let's take the last few minutes to kind of think about some of these closing thoughts, these things that like, if we didn't talk about them, we would be like, ah, God, we gotta, you know, like, what should we, what do you want to hit on now as we're sort of winding down? It's sort of like that horrible thing. And you felt it as the therapist and anybody who's listening who has been in therapy has felt it too. Like, oh no, the hour is coming to an end. So what do we want to make sure that we hit before we move on to our final two questions?
Well, one thing is about representation in general. People that look like us, people that are women of color and are, you know, not only mental health professionals, but in other, you know, other professions, specifically in academia, we are not represented. Just everybody can go try this. Google the university and whatever department you want and type in faculty. You are going to notice a ridiculous amount of older white males, just the faculty pictures and profiles. You can try this, try any university. I mean, luckily I'm at a university that's socially justice oriented, and this is a little bit less true, but in most universities, especially research ones, which, you know, do not allow for, you know, the non-elite in many senses, like the Ivies, you know, it's really hard to get in there as a student, but even as a professor, you know, getting through those doors without a connection is just something not really heard of. So try that out and be saddened and sit with that discomfort, because people that are my age or, you know, my gender or my ethnicity, so on and so forth, are not in these settings. We didn't even touch on socioeconomic status, but I wasn't raised rich, unfortunately. I mean, maybe I'd be a Harvard professor rather than at Governor State right now. If I was born into money, I would say.
Yeah, but then you'd be a Harvard professor. You know what I mean? It's like, sometimes I feel like, yeah, I think that the privilege, and yes, there is a lot of privilege with it, also comes with, I don't know, man, I don't think I would want to do that.
Well, fun fact, I presented at Harvard Med a couple years ago, and one, I felt the most out of place I ever have in my life, because I was probably one of the few people that were under 50, so I already felt weird. I did not get treated very nicely by the other attendees. I just presented a simple poster. I wasn't like one of the, you know, the keynote speakers or anything, but man, did I feel out of place. And I noticed that a lot of people just didn't speak to me. One person thought I worked there, like working like, one of the sponsored booths of the conference. But you know, that I expected to happen. Like we talked about me thinking I was a high school student and stuff like that. But, yeah, like I felt so out of place and I shouldn't, I was qualified to be there just like everybody else. My abstract was blind review, peer reviewed, accepted, and I deserved to be there just like everyone else. But me being, you know, in my mid-20s and being a woman of color there, I just felt so out of place. I got spoken to very harshly. I got some looks, some microaggressions, and yeah, so we're not well represented at all. And I want so badly, you were saying to touch on the things that we need to, I want so badly for people that look like me, sound like me, people from my culture, my gender, from, you know, it, from any of these marginalized identities, to be in a position of power. And academia is something that, you know, they call it like the ivory tower and all of these other connotations that really make sense if you think about it, but and are so true and horrible. And we make memes about them and laugh about them and cry on social media, but we have those things for a reason. We are not well represented. And I want to see young women of color in these positions of power. I want to cite your peer-reviewed paper, and I want to amplify your voice, and I want to help any way I can, and I just want to see you and hear you.
Yeah.
Basically.
Yeah. Oh, I love that. Well, that I think that kind of speaks, Iman, to my final two questions. And I'm interested, is that your answer to one of them, or do you have something in addition to add to that? And they are, and I think you know this, but I'm going to repeat them just for everybody listening. Number one, when you think about the future in whatever context is relevant to you right now, it could be personal, it could be professional, it could be local, global, cosmic. Number one, what is the thing that keeps you up the most at night? The thing that you're really concerned about, pessimistic, maybe even, you know, cynical about. But then on the flip side of that, what are you genuinely optimistic about? What are you, you know, authentically looking forward to?
So, you know how when we started talking, you said this is like a therapy session.
Mm-hmm.
So are you ready for this therapy session about what keeps me up at night? Because
yes, please.
I mean, I went straight to school my whole life and I graduated at 27 with my PhD. So, my work keeps me up at night,
mm-hmm,
and
yeah,
literally, figuratively, everything. So metaphorically, my work keeps me up at night with, you know, the issues of the world that weigh really heavily on me. So the population I do research with literally keeps me up at night. So incarcerated populations, and just thinking broadly, the injustice experience, whether it's, you know, the specific population or the families experiencing trauma and all of these issues that coincide with incarceration, that literally keeps me up at night, as well as just what we would call, like, you know, first world problems in couple relationships, like infidelity and financial issues are two top reasons why couples separate and why couples come to therapy and have issues. And what I talk a lot about with couples that I'm working with, their whole, you know, existence can be put into this relationship, their whole identity, and people, you know, relationships are what surround us. Relationships are so important. And so the things that keep them up at night keep me up at night. Like, you know, their whole world came crashing down because their partner cheated on them. And then I'm thinking about the eight other people I worked with that day and how that affects their life. And then that weighs on me. So I think the injustices of the world in the most broad sense keep me up at night. And then literally my work keeps me up at night because I don't think I can pick. I love teaching. I love doing research. And I love seeing clients. I love supervising. I love mentoring. So my work keeps me up at night. But then because I believe so much in work-life balance and I keep very much in contact with my friends that live in different states and family members that don't live around me, that keeps me up at night too. And actually having fun, because I believe that even though my work, you know, started because of a lot of things in my life and a lot of my passions, that it's not everything. Like, yeah, I'm a therapist and I have the doctor title, but that doesn't necessarily make up all of me. And I believe relationships are my job, literally and figuratively my job. And so they are my passion. So my own relationships are so important to me. So all of that keeps me up at night, which is to say that if there are any medical doctors listening, my physical health is in extremely poor state because my sleep schedule is horrific. So I
they physically keep you up at night. Yeah.
Yes. My lifestyle is not recommended at all. So yeah, that all keeps me up at night.
What about on the flip side? You know, what are you really hopeful for? What are you looking forward to?
So I get really excited, probably way too invested in a sense of with the, you know, the students I work with and the clients I work with. So they give me hope because when they are actually working through these issues, whether it's a student doing research or clients repairing their relationship or getting out of an abusive relationship or so on and so forth, you know, incarcerated individuals reconnecting with their family, communication being enhanced, things like that, that gives me hope. Those little things in someone's yeah. life that have improved and whatever way they conceptualize, because I might not think it's a huge deal that a father started talking to his son again, but it was so important to them and their life. And that gives me hope. It gives me hope in general from what we were talking about, that we're actually having more difficult conversations. It gives me hope that you are amplifying voices like mine that have been historically silenced in my own life. And then, you know, historically in, you know, America's history, that, you know, my parents and, you know, family members have not been a part of because they weren't in this country, but that these things are becoming more normative. And I like to say that, you know, mental health the stigma is being lessened. I don't think it's completely unstigmatized, but I think that having conversations about mental health is being less stigmatized at this point, and being brought to awareness and talked about more, as well as issues of racism and discrimination. We are at least more willing to have the conversation that we've ever have been in our history. So all of that gives me hope, and it makes me think, okay, my work as, you know, a doc student was getting published, and my work now is getting published as, you know, the rank of assistant professor. I hope that eventually I'm an associate professor, and, you know, these ranks help me get the work out there, and my position and title helps me to be heard so that, you know, these issues can be talked about more openly. So I hope that, you know, or I guess I just hope that this happens for everyone.
Yeah.
When I see it in myself, it gives me hope that it's happening within other people that this has happened to as well.
Well, and I think that that's such kind of brings everything full circle. And it's such an important point that we might not have really driven home. And I think you and I know this really well, but it does bear repeating that representation is everything. And so seeing people who look like you, sound like you, and who have these strengths in a position of power and in increasing positions of power and being out loud and proud and being unafraid. This is what will inspire younger girls who see that and say, I can see myself in her and I'm not afraid. And I think that for that reason, I really, I thank you. I thank you for being here. I thank you for sharing your story and for being really kind of like out loud and proud. It means an awful lot to me personally. I think it means an awful lot to the listeners of the show, to the community as a whole. And Iman, thank you so much for being here. It was just a really, really important conversation, and I had a blast.
Thank you so much. I fully connect with so much of everything you said and your work, and I just am so thankful to have had this conversation with you.
Absolutely. And everybody listening, thank you for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.